Get ready for the smartest bundle in streaming. 6 streaming services for the intellectually curious. Featuring Curiosity Stream with the best collection of documentary films and TV shows. Psalm TV and great stories from the world of wine. Taste Made for the fun side of food and travel. Topic with the best thrillers and crime stories. And so much more. From nature to history, technology to food, mystery to adventure. Get 6 streaming services for one low price and less than $6 a month. It's the best deal in streaming. Learn more and sign up now at smartbundle.com.
You probably heard about tourism in the Chernobyl exclusion zone. I've been there myself several times, and it's nothing like what you see in games or horror movies. There are no ghosts, mutants, or radioactive anomalies, and death isn't waiting for you at every corner. Actually, I think it's one of the most peaceful and prettiest places on Earth. An example of strength of nature and how it can reverse the damage that we caused it. Thus, when my friend Alexei decided to go there, he knew who to contact. He's a physics student, and right now he's doing some kind of research on nuclear fallout, and he said that he wanted to get some direct measurements and samples. But we both knew that it's just an excuse to go on an adventure. We visited the old power plant, the abandoned city Pripyat, and the surrounding exclusion zone. It was nice, but I would probably just bore you with more details. That part is not important anyway. We were driving on some dirt roads in a forest east of Pripyat when we found it. An old rusty fence and a chained gate that blocked any further passage. There was a big sign with a radiation hazard symbol and captioned, "Restricted Area, Authorized Personnel Only." There was a pair of massive metal blast doors in the side of an artificially looking hill not far behind the fence, with a large white O13 painted on it and "No Entry" sprayed on top. "What do you think it is?" Alex asked. "I don't know. Looks like some kind of bunker," I replied. "And it looks like it's been closed for some time," I added after taking a closer look at the doors. Both halves were welded shut in the center. Alex took his samples and readings, but we were too puzzled to leave just yet. "Do you think we can go in?" I asked. "Well, not this way for sure, even if it wasn't welded sealed. I'm sure we have no way of unlocking it," Alex replied while examining the massive door. "It looks like an underground bunker. They must have had a way to pump air inside, and I don't think this is it. There has to be another way to get in," I said. We circled the main entrance to find other means of entry. The day was already coming to an end, and it was slowly getting darker. As we were searching, a thought crossed my mind. Why would they weld the doors? What's so important inside that they went this far to keep people away? "Look, there's something there." Alex pulled me away from my thoughts. It was a concrete block a couple of meters large with what looked like vents on the side. As I looked into the vents, I noticed that they were also sealed with heavy-looking steel hatches and no clear way to open them. However, there was also a somewhat smaller door labeled "Service Tunnel" with a large wheel on the outside. "Should I open it?" I asked. "Yeah, I really wonder what this is. Anyway, we don't have to go in. At least we'll see if the door still works." At first, the wheel wouldn't turn because of all the rust and dirt, but eventually it budged. The door unlocked. I pulled, and it slowly started opening. It was very heavy and took a lot of force. Behind the door, there was a small platform in a tight vertical tunnel with a ladder. What caught my attention was that there was an identical-looking mechanism on the inside. That meant they could lock the door from both sides. But why? We were lucky, because if they had locked it from the inside too, there would be no way to get in. I stepped inside and shined my phone light down the shaft. It wasn't strong enough to hit the bottom. The air was damp and old, and there was something that I couldn't identify. A very faint, chemical-like smell. There was no radiation, nor signs of any other hazards. You've got to be kidding me. This is so cool. We have to come back here and check it out later, Alex said. I couldn't agree more. It was almost dark now, so we resealed the door and called it a day, but we promised ourselves to return. I immediately tried to do some research when I got home, unfortunately, with no success. I even tried to call Pavel, a friend of mine who knew the area better than me. Actually, it was him who brought me there the first time. He couldn't help me either, but promised to ask around. I told him about our plan and asked if he wouldn't go with us. But unfortunately, he was out of the country for a while. A week later, we packed our gear and went on with it. We brought some rope, heavy flashlights, glow sticks, Geiger counters, waterproof protective clothes, an oxygen meter, and a small emergency scuba tank just in case. And yeah, we're not stupid, so we told our relatives and friends about our trip and when we are expecting to return. We closed the door behind us as we descended down the access shaft. We couldn't know what's down there, and we didn't want to cause a radiation leak or something like that. We eventually dropped down into a concrete tunnel which enclosed the air vents and some smaller pipes. There was obviously no power, and thus no lights. Good thing we brought our own. We followed the tunnel and reached another door, but this time it was a regular one, not the heavy bunker type. We went through and entered a room with four large air pumps and some electrical equipment and controls. The ventilation shaft split here into two larger ones that ran straight into the ground, and two smaller ones that went straight across the room where there was another set of doors. Behind the doors, there was a large hall with numerous boxes, crates, and other cargo just laying around. There was also a security checkpoint. Behind the checkpoint, we found the main door that we have seen from the outside. Just next to it, there was some heavy lifting equipment. We returned through a checkpoint and took a look at a set of elevators. There was a simple map with the layout of the facility floor by floor. We were on floor zero, main entry hall. There were another four floors below us. Floor one, offices, security, and recreation. Floor two, secure laboratories. Floor three, accelerator, clean room, decontamination chamber. Floor four, experiment site. The map was titled Object 13. It wasn't a military bunker. This was a research site. We took a set of stairs, since the elevators were of no use without power. An unsettling thought brushed my mind as we were descending. They probably were moving some supplies, and then left them there and took the equipment to the main door. Were they trying to get out? I stepped on another stair step, but something rolled away under my foot, lost my balance, and fell on my back. My pack luckily absorbed the impact. I looked under my feet to see what caused my fall. Empty bullet casings. This wasn't the sole reason why I felt odd about this place. As soon as we got down to level one, I noticed that every single door was open. Every single one. There was a canteen and a kitchen right at the beginning of a long rectangular corridor. Various offices surrounded the corridor. There was the regular staff, paperwork, old computers, personal belongings, all right there where they left it. Did they leave in a hurry? Dimitri, Alex called from the canteen on the opposite side of the corridor. What? Was all I could say when I followed him to the canteen. There was food still neatly served on the tables, but it wasn't spoiled. It wasn't fresh either. But it wasn't decaying, as a 30-year-old meal should. How is this possible? I asked. I don't know. Maybe it was irradiated or something, but it's not anymore. I checked that. I really don't know, man, he answered, as puzzled as I was. Oh, why didn't we just turn back and leave? Now that I'm writing this, there were so many red flags already. Something really wrong happened down there. But I guess we were too excited and curious. But it was at this point that my excitement started to fade and be replaced with an eerie feeling. Nevertheless, we continued and descended down to level 2. The stairwell ended here, and to go deeper, we would have to cross the entire floor to reach another one on the opposite side. There was a security checkpoint and a large blast door that we had to pass through to reach the labs. Again, every door was wide open. However, the things that people left here weren't neatly placed where they should have been. It was a mess everywhere. There were all kinds of rooms with all the kinds of equipment that I didn't understand. Occasionally, there were more empty bullet casings on the ground. There still was the one central rectangular corridor as above, but the rooms around it were like a little maze. Almost at the other side of the floor, we found the head scientist's office. As I said, everywhere it was a mess, but I found a logbook on the desk. There was only a handful of pages, the rest torn out. 5th of October, 1984. Today we successfully managed to translocate several atoms without changes in any physical properties. It's going to be a long road until we can transport solid objects. But we're doing some good work here. 17th of January, 1985. We've managed to transport an apple today. However, I couldn't help but notice that the pattern of red and green skin on top was slightly different. But it was still the same apple, with the same structure, shape, everything. We also tried to transport some electronics. They were unharmed and in working order. I think we still have a lot to do to perfect and learn about this technology. But we cannot slow down now. The country is relying on us. 21st of February, 1985. After the animal trials, we translocated our first human today. He is alive and healthy, a brave hero of our nation. We have proven that this technology works now, but the practicality is still very limited, due to the fixed translocation ratio. We still cannot send matter, only exchange the positions of two equally massive objects. I have proposed a new type of device that could possibly achieve one-way translocation of just a single object, but it would need an immense amount of energy. 1st of May, 1985. Our superiors accepted my proposal. They are going to build a new, much bigger translocator here, in the power plant, so we can use a nuclear reactor as a direct power source. There is one more thing. We've now translocated dozens of test subjects. Each one is alive and well, but sometimes they are a little bit, well, different. They sometimes claim that various events in the past happened differently than they really did. Sometimes they claim to know people who don't exist, or more alarming, they know people who they are not supposed to know. The following was written below with a pencil by hand. Test Subject 28 was speaking an unknown language and couldn't understand any real language after the experiment. There was a lot of missing pages afterwards. 25th of April, 1986. We are going to try to change our approach. It's been more than a year and we're still unsuccessful in eliminating the translocation symmetry anomaly. We still even don't know what is causing it, but we are not going to make any progress this way. Today we are going to try to access the conduit reality instead. Even though Unit 2, the one we built in the power plant, is still new, we're going to use it for this experiment. Who knows what wonders are waiting for us on the other side? There was one last page in the logbook. On it, it was just a single phrase, written again and again. We let them in. "Alex, I think we should go," I called. "Man, come take a look at this," he answered. I stepped out of the lab and back into the hallway. There were clothes all over the corridor. Well, what was left of them? They were torn to shreds. No bodies, no blood. Just strips of cloth and an occasional shoe or a watch. I looked up and stared down the dark corridor in front of us. I just stood there for a while. It was, I don't know, as if something torn all these people to shreds and then cleaned it all up, except the clothes and other non-organic material. A wave of pure, instinctive dread washed over me. I couldn't move. I didn't even breathe. "Let's just get out of here," Alex said. We turned around and walked away, slowly at first, but we quickened our pace. Our footsteps echoed across the underground structure. "I just want to be out of here, man. We shouldn't have done this," Alex said. I didn't tell him about the logbook, but my thoughts were cut short after a sudden realization. His voice didn't echo. It was just our footsteps. I think he realized, too, because we both stopped and listened. Nothing but silence. I stepped forward. Clack. I took another step. Clack. There was this door just in front of us, and I forced myself to try something. I closed it behind us as we passed it and placed a glass beaker that I found on the ground on top. I took a step forward. Silence. It was just an echo after all, I thought. We walked away, carefully at first, but then we once again quickened our pace. We turned around a corner, and then it happened. Crash. The glass shattered. Someone, or something, just opened the door. We dropped all our gear except our lights and ran as fast as we could. I didn't even know I could run this fast. I always tried to be a tough guy, but I was never so scared in my life. Our footsteps didn't echo anymore, or better said, they weren't in sync with ours anymore. Something was running after us. Each second it was getting closer and closer. As soon as we reached the security checkpoint, we started closing the door. The rusty joint of the door squealed in protest, but we pulled with all our strength. We almost had it closed when we heard a loud, guttural, and unnatural growl. The door slammed shut, and I threw the wheel to the locked position. My heart was pounding so hard that it was all I heard for a while. No, wait. It wasn't my heart. It was that thing, pounding on the locked blast door. We were running again. We reached the stairwell and ran up, taking 2 to 3 steps at once. We finally reached the air pump room. The ascent really exhausted us, and even though I was scared to hell, I felt like I would pass out if I took another step forward. Besides, we locked it down there. Alex sat down and leaned his back on one of the large vertical vents with a bang. Bang, bang, bang. Oh, hell. We locked it down there. But we forgot the vents. Alex and I looked at each other. Our eyes met. And then the vent burst and he was gone. I only heard him scream as he was dragged back down. I felt terrible for doing this. But I just ran. I climbed the service shaft and locked the service door shut when I was finally out of this hell. As soon as I had phone service again, my phone started beeping with loads and loads of missed calls and messages from Pavel. "Hey, Dimitri, I found this guy. He says he knows what O13 is. Please pick up as soon as you can. He says it's dangerous and you should stay out of it. This guy is calling me now. He sounds serious. Please call me back at once." "I don't know what's going on, but he's going there. Please, I hope you get this before you go down. Stay safe, friend." There was also one message from an unknown number. "Dimitri, this is Anatoly Moroz. I know what you have found, and I'm on my way from Kiev now. Do not go down there. If you already did, and you managed to get out, lock the door that you used to get in, and make sure it stays locked. I will try to call you when I'm here." So here I am, writing this while I wait. I do this to make sure that no one else repeats our mistakes, since I don't know if I'll live long to tell anyone personally. I just can't leave Alex behind. I have to go back. Freaking college kids. What does the sign at the fence say? No entry. What does this here say? He pointed at the text sprayed across the main door. No freaking entry. You think we just put these up because we don't have anything better to do? Like you? You really have nothing else to do but to snoop around things you have no business in. He sighed. Now look what happened. Look what you did. What your awesome idea brought you. Moroz yelled after I finished explaining what happened. First thing he did when he arrived was to check the service tunnel and make sure it is closed. He didn't even talk to me. He just ran there and made sure it is sealed and locked. He was an average-looking guy, probably in his mid-50s, but I think people would say that he looked older than he really was. What is this place? I asked. You have no idea, he said, stood up and walked to his car. What are you doing? I'm going to save your friend, and you're coming with me. You will do everything, exactly as I say, and nothing else. Stay quiet. Try not to exhaust yourself. The air is not circulating, and you'll burn all the oxygen and suffocate. You will stay tethered to me by this line. He lifted what looked like a small retractable winch. When I turn off my light, you will do the same immediately, and you won't move. He continued and pulled out a shotgun from the car's trunk. Are these going to help? I asked. To an extent. But don't use it unless I tell you to, he said and handed me a pistol. Last thing, do you know how ozone smells? He asked, and I nodded. Good. If you smell ozone, run. I started considering whether this was a good idea when he chained and locked the door from the inside with a massive padlock. This is the only way we can keep them from getting out, he said when he noticed me watching him. Hell, of course this was a bad idea. Worst one I've ever had. So let me rephrase. I was contemplating whether I would ever see that padlock open ever again. Am I going to get a key? I asked, watching him close it with a loud click. Sorry, I have just one. But don't worry, I'm right here, he said, sliding his hand across the line that we were connected through. The tether reeled back and forth between us as we walked through the service tunnel. It gave me some sense of security. I could be sure not to get lost and separated from the only other person nearby. It created a sort of weird rhythm with the diesel fuel that sloshed around in the large canisters we carried. Our first stop would be the generator room on the other side of the main entry hall. The generator rattled and hummed as it slowly started spinning up. Did you see it? Moroz asked. Why? We have some time for talking until it turns on. Did you get a good look at what took your friend when it happened? No, I answered. What is this place? I asked again. He stared into the air, sighed, and explained. It was originally a military stockpile in the 50s. In the late 70s, it was then repurposed into a research site. Anything that was too crazy for the public to know about, they've done it here. And it was some screwed up stuff sometimes. Then, they had this project about teleportation. They even rebuilt half of the facility to house it, and that's when it all went to hell. How do you know all this? I asked. I used to work here, he said. So what are these things? I asked. They are... He turned. He started, but then brushed it off. I don't know. I was just an assistant. Is there someone who knows? Not anymore. Everyone who knew, well, let's say they never left this place. And how did you get out? The engine clutch engaged with a click, and the generator finally came to life. I didn't. I took a sick day when it happened. The lights turned on for a brief moment and then shut down again as the circuit breaker popped. That's okay. We can't spare the power for the lights. We'll need it someplace else. You'll see, Moroz said. Whatever happened here? Whatever killed all the people down here and God knows how it was all connected with the Chernobyl disaster? He wasn't there. He took a sick day. He took a sick day. Come on, kid. Let's go. We were at the lab security checkpoint that me and Alex closed earlier during our escape. Remember, stay as quiet as you can now, Maras told me, and we slowly opened the blast door. To our surprise, light blinded us immediately, something shining right at us. I took a step back while my eyes adjusted to the light, and then I finally saw the source of the light. Alexei's flashlight. I went to pick it up, but Moroz quickly stopped me with his arm and pointed into the blackness of the corridor in front of us. For a moment we stood there, silent, and then I thought I heard something in the distance. Moroz immediately turned off his headlamp and gestured to me to do the same while he went to crouch in the corner. I followed and turned off my light too, but we were still lit up. Alex's light was still on, illuminating the room. Moroz quickly cursed, quickly went to grab the flashlight, and then it was dark. Completely pitch black dark. People say that when you're under stress and you lose one of your senses, the other one's heightened to compensate. It's true. Or maybe it was just getting closer. It doesn't matter. I heard something drop to the ground with a muffled splat, then a few irregular footsteps. Not like footsteps of someone walking with a pair of shoes. It was like someone walking barefoot. Flesh on concrete. And they were getting closer. I instinctively grabbed the gun Moroz gave me, hoping I wouldn't need to use it. It was now so close that I could hear a slow, raspy breathing. I think I even felt a cold breeze on my face. Inhale and exhale, in and out. I don't want to think about how close it was. Then something slammed into a wall down the way we came from, with a crash and the sound of glass and plastic breaking. Whatever thing was there with us turned and quickly followed it. I thought that it's gone and I'm safe. Out of nowhere, suddenly a hand brushed against me. I almost jumped and screamed, but the hand quickly moved and grabbed my mouth, preventing me from making a sound. Another hand grabbed my gun. It's me. Follow me, slowly, a voice whispered into my ear. We entered a room on the side and I heard a door close silently. We waited for a while, and then we turned our lights back on. Damn it! Don't ever do that again! I told him, but he wasn't listening. He was looking at droplets of a thick, black liquid on the floor at the other side of the room. What is that? I asked. Blood. At least it was once, Moroz answered, and followed the trail. We traced it across a few rooms until we stopped in a large chemical lab. There was something on the ground in a puddle of the black liquid. It was Alex's knife. There was some red liquid, too. I could tell what it was without a doubt. Fresh blood. A trail of a few droplets went in the opposite direction than the black liquid. Look, he must have gotten away, I whispered. I doubt that. If we want to find him, we have to go to level 4. He just glanced at the knife and then acted like he didn't see anything. Look, this is his knife. They must have fought here and you went that way. I pointed in the direction where the blood trail went. He must be hurt. That's one reason for us not to waste time. Let's go. He stepped off back into the central corridor. I wanted to stay and search for Alex, but the tether that connected us wouldn't allow that. So I obliged and followed. Initially. Moroz, please tell me what is going on. How do you know he's not here? Because I know. Just shut up. We don't have time to argue. We weren't whispering anymore. I'm not going anywhere until you tell me why you were so sure, I insisted. Because he's dead. What? But you said... Come on. Let's go. This is not a place where we want to stay. We have to get down to level 4. Moroz cut me off. No. I trusted him at first, because he was the only one who could help me and help Alex. That was the only thing I focused my mind on, saving Alex. Only now I was realizing what I had gotten into, how blind and how stupid I was. He wasn't just an assistant, as he claimed, and we weren't here to save Alex. I started unbuckling my end of the tether. "What the hell are you doing?" he asked, raising his voice. "I'm going out. Give me the key to the padlock," I demanded. "No, I can't do that," he said with agitation in his voice. I had no choice. I raised my gun at him. "Give me the key," I demanded again. "You really think I would give you a working gun?" "You're not going anywhere," he said, and pointed his shotgun at me. I pulled the trigger, but there was only a click. Damn. "Why are we here? Why didn't you call your friends, your superiors, or whatever to take care of this? But you have to hold me at gunpoint?" "Let's say we don't share the same goals anymore, but have no doubt they are coming here. But not with guns, with concrete. They are going to seal this place up for good, and we have to be quick if we want to be out by the time that happens." "Why can't you just please let me leave now?" I asked, my voice shaking. "Because it's a two-man job," he said and looked me in the eyes. "There are things much more important than you, me, or your friend." I couldn't deny that. Maybe he was right, but I couldn't do this, and I didn't understand anything. "Who are you?" I asked him, returning his gaze. But then I looked away. Something caught my attention, movement behind Morrow's. It was a creature, crawling across the ceiling towards us. Its body vaguely looked like a human, but its skin was pale and stretched tight over its thin bones. Its veins were visible through the skin, filled with the same black fluid we found earlier. It had no hair, and only holes where its nose and ears used to be. Its eyes were bloodshot, locked in a blank stare. We escaped it before, but our argument brought it back. It was too late to run now. Moroz noticed my stare, but he wasn't fast enough. The creature lunged at him. At the same time, he turned around and fired a shot, but missed, and the thing knocked him to the ground. That shot was deafening, in such a tight space. I heard only ringing in my ears. My eyes were slightly blinded by the muzzle flash. In the confusion, I turned to run, but I forgot that I was still tethered to Moroz. After the line was completely reeled out, it jammed, stopping me right in my track and sending me falling to the ground. I looked back and saw that the creature was now looking at me. Moroz was laying on the ground. I must have pulled it off him by yanking on the tether, and now it would come to make sure it won't happen again. I finally managed to disconnect the tether and threw the useless pistol at the creature, hitting its head. I briefly stumbled and I ran to the only place that quickly came to mind. I barricaded myself in a storage room adjacent to the large chem lab, blocked the door with a shelf. The creature spent a minute trying to get in, but then gave up and left, presumably to finish off Moroz. And I stayed there, just sitting in the corner, too scared to do anything. I don't know how much time had passed, but it was starting to get hard to breathe. For a time, I thought I would just stay there and end it all, peacefully, instead of a violent death that was likely waiting for me at the other side of the door. But then I heard a voice call my name. Alex's voice. "Alex, is that you?" I called back. "Oh, thank God. I thought I would die here. You came back," he answered. I went to open the door, but then changed my mind. "How did you find me?" I asked. "I was hiding too, but then I heard gunshots and I came here to look. Dimitri, please come out. We have to get out of here." I sat down again. Maybe it was really him, but what if it wasn't? I didn't want to find out. "No, he said you were dead. I saw blood too. No, it isn't you. It can't be." "What? I don't. What are you talking about, Dimitri? One of those things got me pretty good, but I'm alive. Dimitri, just please come out and let's get out of here," he pleaded. I have decided. I wouldn't open the door. But then I changed my mind once again after what he said. "Dimitri, do you remember the cherry tree? I knew you would come back. We used to play at this huge cherry tree when we were kids. We used to climb it all the time, but one day, I had this idea to make a bet. Whoever gets the highest wins. I got almost to the top, but then I realized how bad an idea this was. The branches under me were too thin, and I knew they could break under my weight any time. But Alex didn't want to lose. He tried to climb even higher than me, and then the twig he was standing on broke, and he fell. Luckily, he landed in a pile of fallen leaves and only broke his leg. He could have killed himself if he fell on the solid ground. And it was my fault. I almost got him killed because of a stupid bet. We decided not to tell anyone how it happened because we were both afraid of getting in trouble. But I felt guilty for it for the rest of my life. There was no way how he could know about the cherry tree if it wasn't him. I opened the door, and there he was. He looked terrible, bruises and scrapes all over, and he had a blood-stained, torn piece of shirt wrapped around his left hand. "Are you okay?" I asked. "I've been better. Let's just get out of here," he replied. "That's not going to be that easy," I said. I told him what happened until now and that the door was locked. Only Moroz had the key, and he was either dead or gone. "There were some tools and supplies up there, right? Maybe we can find something to cut the chain," Alex said, and we decided to give it a try. It was better than searching for Moroz's key after all. We found his shotgun stained with blood, both his and the creature's, and immediately felt safer. We also picked up our packs that we dropped earlier. Luckily, our gear was still there. We carefully walked back to the main hall, but I felt that something was watching us all along. We saw a few old saws and files next to the main door. We grabbed all we could, but we weren't alone. The inhabitants finally decided to make their move. One of the thin creatures crawled out of the stairwell. I aimed and fired. It fell down from the ceiling, twitching like a dying insect. But it didn't matter, because it wasn't alone. Another one crawled out. Then another, and another. We ran to the air pump room and blocked the door by jamming a large saw between the handles. We worked quick because we knew it was only a matter of time until they got through, or came through the vents. Alex couldn't operate the shotgun with his hurt hand, so he offered to do the cutting while I stood guard, ready to kill anything that would come out of the vents. It was working, but it was too slow, way too slow. Alex barely got through a few millimeters when I thought that the door would break already. They were pounding on it, slamming into it, and I saw it rattle in its hinges. I thought that they would get through any moment now, and then they stopped. I heard them run away. I coughed when a sharp odor hit my nose. "Ah, what is that?" Alex asked. "Ozone," I answered. I apologize for ending this part here, but I have to take a break. It's not exactly easy for me to talk about this. Besides, it's already getting quite long as it is. Fear not, though. I will explain what happened after this soon enough. I just need some time to collect my thoughts. So I made a post last night about an experience I had in this house. So I decided to compile a bunch of experiences I had into a few posts. First, I'm going to set the scene so that you can all imagine my stories as they are happening. I lived above an Ace Hardware store in Pennsylvania. You walk about 30 stairs to my porch, and there were two apartments at the top. Mine, you walk in, and you were immediately in my kitchen. You could either go through the door arch on the left to my living room, or to the right in my laundry room, which was connected to my bathroom, and our real long hallway, which was also connected to the living room at the end. Now, walking down this hallway, you have the blue room to the left, bedroom painted blue, and you had the double doors, which was two rooms with a knockdown wall making it one room. On the right, you have a bedroom with a bathroom in it. You keep walking straight down the long hallway, and at the very end was a little space that might have been a bedroom with no windows, and a huge, creepy attic door. Little things started happening immediately upon moving in. My parents would have phone alarms set to around 3 a.m. that they never set. The AC window units would turn off and on. The temp would be adjusted to super low temperatures. TVs would turn on and be left on until we woke up the next day. We would hear random bumps in the night. The doorknobs would jiggle. I have two siblings. At this moment, my younger brother lived in the creepy back room. He loves weird bedrooms, and my sister lived in the double room and I lived in the blue room. I was up until 3 a.m. watching A Haunting on TV and playing on my computer. I am a night owl, so 3 a.m. is just a time to me. I heard someone coming down the hallway, and it sounded like heavy boots. I yelled out to my brother and told him to stop screwing with me. I got no answer in reply. So I snuck up to the hallway door to chuck my shoe at him. I chucked it into thin air. Nothing. My brother was sound asleep, so I went and woke my sister up and made her sleep in my room with me. We were laying in my bed watching TV when we heard boots again. We were laying in my bed watching TV, and we heard the boots again. And it got louder and louder until they stopped at my door. She bolted and slept with my parents, leaving me at the mercy of this freaking demon outside my door. I ended up falling asleep and was fine. One day I got home by myself. I am not sure where my siblings were. I am pretty sure my brother stayed at school for practice and my sister was with friends. My parents were both still at work. At this time, I had the bedroom with the bathroom. The bathroom had a weird built-in crawl space cupboard thing above my door. I walked in and was changing out of my school clothes so I could go out and hang out with my friends. I was changing when I heard the latch on the crawl space. The latch was super old and hard to open. I looked up as I was holding my breath, just staring at it, because the latch had a very distinct sound. After a couple seconds, the door swung open. The bathroom door swung open and my bedroom door swung open. I ran out and called my friend who sat on the porch with me until my parents got home. My best friend spent many nights with me. And this time takes place when I lived in the double room with my sister. Me and my best stayed up until curfew was lifted watching TV with two of our guy friends. They walked home as soon as curfew was up, which was like 5 a.m. So at this time, me and her went to my room to lay down. We were laying down and talking when we heard a slight noise. We looked over to this picture on my wall. The picture was pasted to construction paper. It had tape on the top, middle, and bottom. Every single time we started talking, it would peel off the wall little by little. So we stopped to deliberately stare at it when it completely ripped off the wall and flew across the room. We literally trampled each other getting out my door. It was a nice summer day when my mom, me, and my ex-boyfriend were sitting on the porch talking at like 11 p.m. My big door was open and the screen door was shut. My mom and I just finished cleaning the kitchen and decided to sit outside as per usual. We were the only three at the house at this time, besides my dad, who was sleeping for work the next day. We heard what sounded like silverware being tossed in the sink, like the metallic clank sound, and we all looked inside and saw a man walk through the wall into the laundry room. We got up and went inside to check out the house and noticed a spoon sitting in the sink. A single spoon, when we had just cleaned the kitchen spotless. A couple years into living at this apartment, I got pregnant with my now husband, and we lived in the room with the bathroom. Since he moved in, he would always see this tall shadow person standing next to our couch in the corner. When my daughter was a few months old, we used to put her in her swing at night to help her sleep. It was going about half speed, and when you make the swing go faster by pushing it or slower by stopping it, it would click like it was forced. While I am a light sleeper, and I heard the clanking, so I looked at the swing to check on her, and it was going faster than max speed. I freak out and wake my husband up, and we got up to get my daughter, and it came to a dead stop. Needless to say, she definitely did not sleep without us in that room again. On January 11th, 2018, my brother committed suicide. He had severe depression his entire life and had attempted suicide repeatedly. He didn't have any children or a wife or anything like that either. We were very close, best friends, and even lived down the street from each other. He was three houses down, and since the yards were small, we could yell to each other from our driveways. Anyway, he didn't believe in an afterlife, and I didn't know what to believe. And when we were younger, we both made a promise that whichever one of us died first would haunt the other one as much as possible so that we would know there's really an afterlife. I'd had extremely weird experiences as a child, but I wasn't sure if it was my imagination and thought that experiencing it as an adult would give me peace of mind. Well, immediately after he died, strange things started happening. It would get especially active during or shortly after dreams of him, too. First of all, our dog, Remy, didn't like him, and she would growl when she saw him, so we had to put her in her crate or another room when he was over. She started growling all of the time at home, while she's normally very quiet. She would stare at random empty spots like the kitchen, a hallway, the wall, and just growl. It was every day for the first few months after he died. Lights also started turning on and off in my house. Doors would open and close. The baby would start giggling and laughing, or staring and babbling at nothingness when alone. When I was at work, several times, items would come flying off of shelves at me. But the real kicker for me happened exactly a month after he died, and on the 10-year anniversary of our mother's death, February 11th, 2018. Where I work, there are motion-activated lights. I work midnights, and often, there are little to no employees there. On this particular night, almost no machines were running, and there were only six employees in the building, including myself. Two were busy running one machine. The other three were busy dealing with a coil that was dropped. I walked off on my own to put bands on stand-up coils of steel. I was over there a while, as there were quite a few. Because it's a very large building, and sometimes there's only a few employees in the building, the lights are motion activated. The lights around me were all off. While I was putting a band on, I noticed a figure walking towards me out of the corner of my eye. The lights along the walkway started to turn on as the figure approached. I didn't immediately turn my head or anything, because I figured that it was probably the supervisor walking over from where the falling coil was at to come check up on me. However, when the figure got closer to me, like two car lengths away, I turned to say hi. But suddenly, there was no one there. The walkway is very wide, wide enough for two fork trucks, which are much bigger than a regular forklift, about as big as an SUV. To easily maneuver like a two-way street. There was nowhere for a person to easily duck and hide without having to run for a few moments in either direction, like if a person were walking down the middle of a street. I knew that I hadn't imagined it either, because the lights were all on. I knew it wasn't the people at the machine, because I could hear it running, and they had to stop it if one of them wandered off. So I walked over to the dropped coil, where the supervisor and two other employees were. They were all still working on it. I asked the supervisor if he had walked over to check on me, and he said no, and that he'd been there the whole time. He gave me a funny look, but all I said back was okay. I walked over to the bathroom. There's only one woman's bathroom in the whole plant, and it's right by the time clock. I looked over and noticed that it was after midnight now, and now the 10-year anniversary of my mom's death. None of these things scared me. I just thought it was my brother, so I was just calm and would sometimes whisper to him. Hi guys, I hope you are all well. It's my first time posting on this subreddit, so be nice. I assume this was the best place to post this. I've not had many paranormal experiences in my life, but this is one that I cannot explain, and therefore I am asking you guys for your input on what happened. I've always been a bit of a skeptic, probably because deep down I'd rather believe that these things don't exist. Life is complicated enough as it is, if you get me. But anyways, on with the story. I am from a small village in Scotland that is northwest of Glasgow, near Loch Lomond. My family have a small holiday cottage on the Isle of Col. If you feel like it, you can have a look on Google Maps to get an idea of where it is. My father's mother was born on this island, and her blood can be traced back to the 1600s on that island. The island only has around 200 inhabitants currently, but it is thought that it used to have 1,000 or so. At its longest, it is around 12 miles. At its widest, it is around 3 miles. There are countless stories or folk tales of people seeing unnatural things on this island, seeing glimpses of battles that happened hundreds of years ago, or seeing old workers walking through your farmhouse who aren't really there. You get the idea. Most people live in houses that have been lived in for a very long time, and some energies have been left behind. Our cottage used to be the dairy, cheesery. The barns around the house still have all the slots for where the cows would stay, etc. It is a very old cottage and has had many owners before us. It was last used as a dairy in the 70s. Fun fact, its cheese was once exported in the House of Lords, London. So what happened? When I was around 10, we extended the small cottage into some ruined piggeries that were attached to the end of the cottage. We probably disturbed some old spirits when we knocked through those old walls, but it had to be done. The renovation meant that me and my sister now both had a bedroom each. My bedroom was pretty much empty apart from some bunk beds at the far end away from the door. For the first year or so, I would feel a bit off about the pitch black room when trying to go to sleep. When I was around 12, I saw her for the first time. She was around my age, stood in the middle of my room, a light from across the courtyard beaming in from a slit in my curtain and hitting the side of her face and body. Clear as day, she was there, stood in the middle of my room. As soon as I saw her, I immediately panicked and turned to face the wall. I spent the rest of that night covered in sweat and shaking in fear. I knew what I had seen. I continued to see her every now and again, sometimes 2 days in a row. She eventually became an expected feature in my room, to me. It got to the point where I could peacefully fall asleep with her in the room, because I knew from experience that all she ever did was stand there. She meant me no harm. She was just as much a part of the room as the stonework around her. I had a close friend come out to the island when I was 14. I had not told him about her. Upon going to bed on the first night we were there, I saw her arrive in the middle of the room. I knew he was still awake as we had just been talking. He was on the top bunk. I was on the bottom one. Silence. I didn't say anything, and neither did he. The next morning, he seemed a bit off. After probing a few times, he finally admitted that he thought he saw a girl in our room the night before. I was a bit scared by this, but also a bit relieved that someone else had finally seen her. I told him about how I'd been seeing her for years, etc. To me, this was proof that I wasn't crazy, and that this little girl was really there. When I was around 15, I made an effort to communicate with her while she was visible and talk with her through the transition of moving on. Not talking with words, but speaking without talking. Almost pleading her, telling her that she had nothing to fear about moving on. There was no benefit to her being stuck where she was. She walked out of my room through my closed door. That was the last time I ever saw her. My dad was on the boat going to call one day when I was around 15 or 16. A family member of ours had died and was being buried on the island that day. My dad was in the lounge area of the boat and just by chance started speaking with an elderly man who was sat across from him. It turned out to be the guy who owned our cottage back in the 70s and 80s. He sold the cottage to the person who sold it to us. By this point, my dad knew that I had seen this little girl in my room on many occasions. It turns out that this elderly man had a daughter. Unfortunately, she died of TB, tuberculosis, at a young age, around 9 or 10. She used to look after the pigs and the piggeries that we knocked into and renovated. She is buried on Tyree, the island next to Call. My dad didn't say anything to the man when he heard this, but it immediately clicked in his head. This was the young girl I had been seeing. Jump to many years later. My dad brings a psychic out to the island to see what she picks up on. He hadn't told her about the little girl. She is very sensitive to these sort of things and is well known for clearing buildings, smudging, etc. They arrived at the cottage during the daylight. We have never seen the little girl during the day. As soon as our friend walks through the doorway of my room, she freezes and starts talking. She said, "There's been a young girl visible in this room recently, maybe around 10 years old. Is this your son's room now?" "Yes." "Has he ever seen her?" "I'm not sure. I think he has helped her move on, but I'm not sure how. She has moved on." If you guys are interested in this story and the island, then I have plenty secondhand stories I can pass on that would fascinate you. In the Hebridean Islands, we call the gift of seeing the future the second sight. In the 60s and 70s, some of the islanders saw some horrific things before they actually happened. I'm sure those stories would interest you a lot. There are countless stories of people seeing spirits in human form. It is a bit creepy, but very interesting. As I said, this is my first post on this subreddit, so be nice if I broke any rules. Looking forward to hearing some feedback from you guys. Peace and love. X. Before I start, I want to make clear that I don't really know what happened. I don't know if it was something paranormal or a very creepy dude. I just wanted to share it. This happened to me back when I was 16 years old. It was summer, and I was spending my days at our family's home in the countryside. My father always gave me a lot of freedom, so I was used to taking long strolls in the heart of the night. It's a rather small town, and I know most of the residents. I never had a reason to be scared. It was around 2 a.m., and I was talking at the phone to a friend, and jokingly, I said I was going to jump the graveyard's fence and take a look around. I was kind of determined to do it, but my phone's battery died halfway through, and I didn't feel like going on without my friend talking to me. So I decided it was time to go back home and took a shortcut. Now I know this sounds very cliche, right? taking the dark shortcut instead of going through the civilized world and stuff like that. But you have to understand the situation. It was something I was extremely used to. And as I said, nothing dangerous ever happened in that town. This shortcut is a 2 kilometers road built on the side of a mountain that became pedestrian area after a section of it collapsed under the weight of a truck. After this event, all the lampposts were dismantled, so using a flashlight is mandatory. After a few minutes I was walking, I started hearing someone whistling, and being late at night and on a remote road, I accelerated the pace. It followed me for a good amount of time, and every time I turned my head to see if I could spot his flashlight, I couldn't find anything. Going around without a flashlight can make you fall in the ravine. Then it stopped. I stopped walking too, to check if it was still following, whoever it was. That's when I heard rustling within the bushes. The year before, I had a frightening experience with a boar on that same road, so I turned off the flashlight and tried to stand completely still without making any sound. The classic click of a camera and the flashlight came out from the bushes, and that's when I lost it. I ran until I was out of breath, and still I wasn't near the end of the road. I took a couple of seconds to relax, because my heart was going to explode, and I turned to face the woods. I stopped right in front of a pathway, before I even realized that I was very exposed. I heard quick footsteps coming at me from that small path, so I ran again, but this time, I didn't stop until I was home. After that, nothing really spooky happened. I didn't find a picture of myself on my threshold. No creepy figures stalked me in the night. Nothing came out from the woods. I didn't tell my father about this, in fear that he would restrict my freedom. And I'm glad nothing frightening actually happened afterwards. Otherwise, I wouldn't have the courage to go back to my family's home every year. Sometimes I go on night strolls on that road, but never without a friend or a relative with me. Growing up, I lived in northeastern Arizona, literally about 5 miles south of the Navajo Reservation in Winslow. Naturally, being that close to the reservation, or the res, skinwalkers were a huge topic of conversation amongst the locals, and we all took it very seriously. Stories of personal experiences abounded. I was no different. Well, to start off my set of stories, I was about 9 or so. My family had gone camping in a little spot about 50 miles or so south of a town called Hart Canyon, near Wiggins Crossing, if anyone is interested. We had been there all day, and I was extremely familiar with the area, as we had camped there 20 or so times before. So my parents let me just wander about alone in the woods. This was back in the early 90s. Anyway, I had some G.I. Joes that I had been playing with in the nearby creek, about 80 yards from our campsite. There were not other campers there with us. My mom had called me back to camp for dinner, so I left and ate. Played around camp for a while and realized that I'd forgotten my toys back at the creek. So I took a flashlight and headed back that way. I knew right where I had left them, so in no time I found them and grabbed them up. As I was squatted down to grab them on the edge of the water, a sudden urgency that I'd never felt before ran down my spine. I remember feeling frozen because of the fear. Like the little boy on E.T. when the alien comes out of the field for the first time and he's trying to scream for his family. I looked up and pointed my flashlight to the other side of the creek, and about 10 yards down the way, I saw something. At first I thought it was a deer, but it was standing up, so I thought it may be a bear, but it was too skinny and not enough poofy hair. It skunked behind a tree and peered out slightly at me. I seriously was too scared to move. I had just read a bit about Bigfoot for the first time, since it wasn't really popular in my area. I thought for a long time that that's what I saw. I finally had seen enough to gather my wits and scram as fast as I could back to camp. I told my parents, and they kind of dismissed it as my imagination. So I just stayed close the rest of the trip. About 2 years later, I was at my house. I had two dogs. They were outside dogs, lived their whole lives in my backyard. One night, they went psycho, barking at first at something in the alley behind my house. Then they both started whimpering. I had my window open slightly, and one of my dogs straight up jumped up to the window, frantically chewed through the screen of the window, forced its way into the house, and would not leave the house for 3 days. Another time, when I was about 13, we used to play night games in my town. Mostly, there being nothing much else to do, we would walk around our neighborhood and act suspicious so the cops would come chase us around. And we would run down the alleyways and hop into random folks' backyards to hide. Now it was extremely common to see an intoxicated Navajo or Hopi in the alley. Or the street. So it was no big deal to see one in the alley behind my house that night, as we being two of my friends and myself, ran from a police car hot on our tail. We saw him plain as day standing in our way. We ran around him and jumped into the nearest yard to hide. We waited for the cop to pass us and hopped back out. Literally about 3 minutes went by. We ran back the way we came, and as we got to the point where the Indian had been, he was gone. Legit. In his place was a coyote sitting there watching us. We ran right past it, feet from it. And anyone who knows coyotes knows they will bail out way before you get close to them. This bugger held his ground and calmly sat and watched us run past him. We all freaked out and stayed inside for a month. My last experience was when I was about 15 or 16. My brother has a girlfriend that lived in a small community south of Winslow called Starlight Pines, about 25 miles-ish. Well, we went to go see her one day, and as we drove out, about 15 miles out, we saw an Indian guy standing on the side of the road, which was quite odd because the res was north of town, and it was rare to see anyone on foot south of town because it's just desert and forest for literally 80 miles. Anyway, we saw this guy. He looked normal enough, flannel shirt, jeans. We got to our destination and hung out with my brother's girlfriend and her family. Well into the night, when we decided to head back home. Hopped in his truck, a Chevy S10, and drove back the way we came. In the same spot we saw the Indian dude, he was still there. I remember thinking, that dude is crazy standing out there all day and into the night. What's he doing? Right as we passed him, we hear a loud bang on the back of the truck. At first I thought we hit an animal, but I hadn't felt anything that we'd run over. I turned around and looked out the back window. My brother started to slow down, thinking there may be something wrong with the truck. In the brake lights, I see the Indian guy chasing after us. We were easily going 55 to 60 at this point as we were about to stop. The guy is in the road, feet behind us. I scream at my brother to not stop. Gun it, man, gun it. He does, and being a Chevy S10, it had a speed governor on it at 80. 2 miles. 2 miles. This guy keeps up with us. We are seriously freaking out. I asked my brother, what if we don't make it back to town, or what about when we have to slow down once we get close? After those 2 miles that stretched forever, I looked back, and he was gone. We got home, booked it into the house, and told our parents. Next morning, I get up to head somewhere and look at my brother's truck, thinking about the night before. I wondered what the loud bang was just before we started getting chased. Inspecting the trunk, I found a handprint smeared in the dust from about 2/3 over to the right, then smeared to the right taillight. I never went there again.
New on CuriosityStream, grab your lab goggles. We're out to find the world's coolest, loudest, and most in-your-face experiments.
Wow, that's impressive.
See how hands-on science can change our everyday lives on Oddly Satisfying Science. Plus, from goats to guard dogs, hear surprising stories about the creatures that brought humanity to the next level. It's animals that changed history. Watch now on CuriosityStream. Annual plans are $20, just $1.67 a month. Visit CuriosityStream.com.